The Debate.
U.S. President Joe Biden has announced an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, indicating that the new administration is planning a more active role in efforts to end the war. In his first foreign policy speeches, President Biden said this war has to end, and to underscore the U.S.'s commitment, Washington would end all relevant arms sales to the Saudis. In reaction to the U.S. president's decision, Yemen's Supreme Political Council said that Yemenis will not be fooled by mere U.S. statements. The announcement also puts the spotlight on a major humanitarian crisis that the U.S. helped aggravate. The reversing of the policy also comes as a rebuke to Saudi Arabia, a major U.S. ally in the Persian Gulf region. The war, which has been accompanied by an all-out siege of the impoverished Arab country, has resulted in the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015, hoping to reinstate former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi and suppress the Ansar Allah movement, who took control of the country after Hadi's resignation. The Saudi-led coalition expected to finish its job in weeks, but it has been nearly 6 years. Riyadh and its allies are stuck in this quagmire. Since day one, the United States and some European countries have been supporting this war either by selling arms to the aggressors or by taking no action toward the crimes being committed against the Yemeni people. Washington also blacklisted the Ansar Allah movement and their supporters while they are defending their country against the aggression. Now the new U.S. administration apparently wants to have a different approach toward the war. In his first foreign policy speech on Thursday, U.S. President Joe Biden called for an end to the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
We're also stepping up our diplomacy to end the war in Yemen, a war which has created a humanitarian and strategic catastrophe. I've asked my Middle East team to ensure our support for the United Nations-led initiative to impose a ceasefire, open humanitarian challenge, and restore long dormant peace talks.
Biden said he will end all American support for offensive operations in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. He added that his administration will push for a diplomatic resolution to the crisis in Yemen and will make sure humanitarian aid reaches the Yemeni people. Nonetheless, the U.S. president also pledges support for Saudi Arabia to defend its sovereignty. Biden's remarks drew reaction from Yemen's Ansar Allah movement. An Ansar Allah spokesman said the only way to restore peace in Yemen is to stop the Saudi-led war and end the blockade. A senior Ansar Allah official also noted that any action without tangible results to end the war will be futile.
I think that Biden has realized that the Saudi war on Yemen, like the Saudi war on Syria, has failed. And what might happen is that the Saudi regime, the monarchy, collapses. And that would be a disaster for the U.S. because it's one of the pillars of their domination of the Middle East. It's one of their main client states in the Middle East besides Israel.
According to the United Nations, the Saudi-led war on Yemen has caused the world's biggest humanitarian catastrophe. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed, while millions displaced since the war started in March 2015. Now that the new U.S. administration wants to show its goodwill and different policy from the previous one, the first step to end the war will be taking Ansar Allah off Washington's so-called terror list. The world has to wait and watch how serious Biden is in his pledge of ending the war on Yemen and bringing peace to the impoverished Arab country.
Joining us on this debate, we have author of No More War, Mr. Daniel Kovala, joining us from Pittsburgh. Also from New York, we have author and activist Sarah Flounders. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Kovalik in Pittsburgh. U.S. President Joe Biden announced an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led military offensive in Yemen, indicating that the new administration is planning a more active role in efforts to end the country's war. Will he act on those comments? For example, will he actually sign the bill, the same bipartisan bill that the Senate tried to get past Donald Trump?
Well, all of that remains to be seen. First of all, obviously, those of us who care about peace, who care about human rights, welcome Biden's statement that he's going to end support of Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen. We've been pushing the U.S. to end its support for the Saudi war for some time. At the same time, the fact that he says, uses words like offensive operations, while saying that he's going to still help Saudi Arabia with its defense and still help Saudi Arabia allegedly go after Al-Qaeda in Yemen, when in fact Saudi Arabia has been partnering with Al-Qaeda in Yemen, makes me wonder what the policy really is. I just think we don't know. Right now, he's, you know, put loopholes in big enough for a Mack truck to drive through. So I think the situation has to be monitored very, very seriously.
Sarah Flounders, the U.S. president said in a speech at the State Department that the war has to end, and to underscore our commitment, we're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. Is that enough, though, ending offensive support? Isn't it about time, in your opinion, for maybe a less hawkish U.S. foreign policy, one with less bombs and more aid and actual diplomacy?
Certainly, this is absolutely true, because it's semantics to say, well, we're going to end some offensive aid, and yet we're going to keep defending Saudi Arabia, really means that there's a back door in this that you could drive a truck through. If there's any sincerity, the first step is to absolutely end the U.S. Foreign terrorist organization label that they've put on the Ansarallah movement, on the Houthi movement, to immediately end the siege, to end the sanctions, to allow immediate aid to arrive in Yemen. Those are the first steps. And just a general statement that the U.S. will now set up a negotiation, we saw where that led in Syria. They've supposedly been negotiating while being actively involved now for many years, and the sanctions have continued and the efforts to stop rebuilding. So what does it mean in Yemen? I think we should use it as an opportunity to really demand that there be real life to this. What the U.S. has found is that they were unable, despite years of bombing, and this was really a U.S. war. It was never Saudi Arabia alone. It couldn't have lasted one day without U.S. technicians, U.S. aircraft, U.S. bombs, equipment, satellite reconnaissance, U.S. Navy blockade. All of this was a U.S. war. Will it really end? That's the question. And will Yemen have a chance to breathe a sigh of relief? Clearly, it didn't succeed. And a people's movement in Yemen has been able to survive and continue a resistance. And we should really salute that struggle and that determination, that resistance, because it shows that it's possible, even against massive bombardment of school buses and schools and hospitals and marketplaces and wedding parties. We should just think of the crimes of the past years.
Danny Kovalik, that's an interesting point. Our guest in New York just brought up, if Biden is serious, here's a first step. Reverse the designation of Ansarallah as a terrorist organization. The UN and aid groups have called the designation to be reversed numerous times, warning that it would push Yemen into a large-scale famine and it would seriously impede humanitarian activities in Yemen. Do you think he'll reverse it?
Well, first of all, I agree that that has to be done immediately. I'm concerned that he has not done it yet. That would not take anything but for the State Department to reverse that. It can be done by fiat. You know, we don't need people to vote on it. Why hasn't he done it yet? So I don't know if he's going to do it, but I agree it has to be done, because once you declare – they've essentially declared the government of Yemen a terrorist organization, and what that means, under binding Security Council resolutions, countries cannot trade with Yemen, they cannot do banking with Yemen, and so, as you know, the UN has raised the alarm that that designation will only deepen the worst humanitarian crisis the world has known since World War II.
Sarah Flounders, reacting to the news of the U.S. president's comments, Yemen's Supreme Political Council said the Yemenis will not be fooled by mere U.S. statements. In other words, they want to see action. Why should they trust Washington? In fact, back in 2015, it was the Obama administration, along with Vice President Joe Biden, that gave Riyadh the support to carry out this war in the first place, as you mentioned also.
Well, it is heartening, their statement, that they will not be fooled, because it means that they really understand deeply from the beginning this was a U.S. war. They know who they're up against. They have clear demands for how to end the siege and how to have legitimate negotiations, if that's what's on called for. But they also see through the Biden administration. There is a new cabinet, but they all, every single one of the people that Biden has named are really war criminals in their threats against Iran for many years, and their war in Afghanistan and in Iraq and in Syria and in Libya and Yemen. So we shouldn't give any credence to Biden or Blinken in terms of the State Department. I think we need to continue real support for a people's movement and struggle in Yemen, and also show confidence they know who they're dealing with. So I thought that the response today, from the Supreme Military Council and from senior officials shows that they, as a political force, know who they're dealing with and are preparing next steps ahead. So it's a difficult time, because this will be used internationally. Biden is trying to position himself in a new way to continue war in the region.
Daniel Kovalik, should the Yemenis trust the United States?
No, of course not. I mean, the U.S. has, look at Vietnam was a famous case where, of course, at every moment we were about to win and pull out of Vietnam, when in fact it went on for many years. Same thing in Afghanistan, right? We're now 20 years into that war. Trump was actually trying to withdraw troops. It's clear that now Biden is going to stop that withdrawal. The U.S. cannot be trusted on this. I will say, though, that, one thing that gives me pause is whether, in fact, Biden does want to end some of the conflicts in the Middle East, because he has his sights on bigger game. For example, the very influential Atlantic Council just released a white paper urging Biden to engage in regime change in China. China clearly being a target of the Biden administration, and possibly Russia. So I agree with my colleague that, whatever the result for Yemen, and obviously we want to see peace in Yemen, I think we have to be vigilant to see what Biden is going to do also in the rest of the world.
Ms. Founders, here's another perspective. Skeptics are saying that Biden is basically just sweet-talking right now, that he's an old wolf of U.S. foreign policy, and he isn't going to let down the U.S.-backed dictatorships in the Middle East that they've armed and supported for so long. Do you see it in that light as well?
I very much do. He is an old wolf, an old war criminal. Let's really say who he is. The staunchest supporter of the U.S. war in Iraq, in Syria, in Afghanistan, and Yemen. And even Blinken in the confirmation hearing said, well, we have to relook at sanctions so they give the greatest pain. Those are his words. A conscious understanding. These are really criminal forces within U.S. policy. But I do so much agree with Dan. They are trying to reposition themselves on how they can really focus attention on China, on Russia, on Iran. And so can they reposition themselves with forces here in the U.S. to disarm the movement here? Can they reposition themselves with European forces, EU, and some of the NATO forces? Can they put a new look on their wars? That's what they're attempting to do. And at the same time, they are going full steam ahead to make new threats on the world. It's a very dangerous time, because clearly the U.S. Economic position is weakening, and their ability to impose their will on the world has been severely challenged. But again, we should really applaud the struggle in Yemen for surviving these difficult years and as a cohesive force with an understanding of what they're up against.
Daniel Kovalev, let's get your thoughts on the matter as well. Do you think that Joe Biden, he's not one to let the likes of the Saudis down, is he?
No, of course not, and he's made that clear. He made it clear publicly, and he also talked to the Saudis before making this announcement, making it clear that the announcement was not going to affect U.S.-Saudi relationships. So clearly, Biden will continue his relationship with Saudi Arabia, continue, it looks like, Trump's policies towards Israel. We just saw that the Senate, for example, unanimously approved to continue the U.S.'s embassy to Israel in Jerusalem, for example. I think he will continue those policies. I think what you're going to see is, you know, at least on its face, a kinder, gentler leader of imperialism. But that does not mean it's any less aggressive or cruel. In fact, Intercept recently reminded us that the CIA, in an internal document, thought Obama was the best leader for the United States because, you know, the world and Americans interested in peace trusted him. And so he was able to get away with things, including the war in Libya, that other presidents could not. And I think Biden will do the same. I mean, the irony of Trump is that while he was coarse and he was poorly spoken and he was openly racist, which are all bad things, he showed the true face of American imperialism, and that was actually a good thing. And I think the world woke up a bit, and Biden is hoping the world's going to go back to sleep.
Sarah Flounders, the reversing of this policy, it definitely is a rebuke to Saudi Arabia, which has been a long time a U.S. Strategic ally. If Biden's position or the U.S.'s position isn't going to change too much, with regards to Riyadh, then what kind of message is this sending to the Saudis?
Well, it's really sending them a message that there's going to be some new positioning, but there's no pullback in military assistance or in diplomatic political support. So the message is, you know, we're changing the game a bit. Don't worry too much. The U.S. well knows how to drag negotiations on for years and make demand after demand on the forces that they're negotiating with. Clearly, they want to demand and try to divide the movement in Yemen. That's their first goal in opening negotiations, who they speak to, who they're speaking to on one ear and then the other. Of course, want to weaken and undermine the position of Iran in the region. And so there's a lot that Saudi Arabia is a real pillar, absolutely, of U.S. Domination and control in the region, but it is a pillar, you know, based on sand. It's a completely corrupt regime held in the hands of one family. With seething discontent below. So, you know, they may be looking for ways even to shore up and get Saudi Arabia out of a very difficult position by more actively engaging in negotiations and not just sitting next to them at the bomb control missions, which is what they've been doing, not just servicing the planes militarily, but intervening more politically with the regime. So, but that's not an effort of liberation at all. It's not an effort at human rights for anyone in the region ever.
Daniel, let's hit rewind here for a second. On the campaign trail for the presidency, Joe Biden said that he would punish Saudi leaders for Jamal Khashoggi's murder, adding that he believed the order was given by the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. He said, and I quote, We will, in fact, make them the pariah that they are, and they have to be held accountable for murdering children in Yemen. I'd like to get your thoughts on those comments made by Joe Biden. Should Riyadh start to worry a little bit if Biden is to keep his election campaign promises?
First of all, I would agree that Riyadh should be punished for these things, particularly the war in Yemen, which is, in my belief, a genocidal war, which has already destroyed hundreds of thousands of lives, destroyed countless UNESCO historic sites. But I don't believe that Biden will do that. I think it's clear he won't. I think if he was going to do that, he would have signaled it. I think that is clearly a promise he is going to back off of.
And Ms. Flounders, your thoughts on that issue as well. We've got probably less than 30 seconds to get your final thoughts.
I very much agree. Biden said a lot of things during his campaign, and so far he's falling short on every single one of them. You know, politicians make campaign promises, and then there's a reality of the institution that they represent, which is U.S. imperialism. They want to continue that domination, and at great cost to the people of the world and the people right here at home. So I wouldn't trust one promise.
All right, thanks a lot. Allow me to thank my guests. Author of No More War, Daniel Cavallo, joining us from Pittsburgh. Also, thanks to author and activist Sarah Flounders speaking to us from New York. And a special thanks to you all for staying with us on this debate. It's good night for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. And if they dispute with you, then say, Allah is most knowing of what you do.
Allahu yahkumu bainakum yawma al-qiyamah.
Allah will judge between you on the day of resurrection concerning that over which you used to differ.
In this program, we will be trying to cover 68th, also 69th verses of this chapter. وَإِن جَادَلُوكَ فَقُلِ اللَّهُ أَعْلَمُ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ. And if they dispute with you, say, Allah knows best what you do. اللَّهُ يَحْكُمُ بَيْنَكُمْ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ فِيمَا كُنْتُمْ فِيهِ تَخْتَلِفُونَ. Allah will judge between you on the Day of Judgment concerning that in which you used to differ. You may remember in the previous program we talked about the 67th verse, لِكُلِّ أُمَّةٍ جَعَلْنَا مَنْسَكَنْهُمْ نَاسِكُوهُ. So the Almighty Allah said that there is appointed different rites for different people and nations. So they are not allowed to dispute with their prophets, and they have to listen to their prophets, and thus they will be actually invited unto the real Lord, and they will be upon a straight guidance, following the prophet which was at the first place. إِنَّكَ لَعَلَى هُدًى مُسْتَقِيمٍ. You are upon a straight guidance, and you will guide people to the straight path if they listen to you. So in this verse it says, وَإِن جَادَلُوكَ فَقُلِ اللَّهُ أَعْلَمُ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ. The divine prophets, with having those plenty miracles and logic, were still confronted with some obstinate people. So in this verse, it has been indicated that if they continue conflicting and having disputes with the Prophet وسلم, and if his words do not affect their hearts, he is to answer them that Allah knows the best about what deeds they have. So the verse says, وَإِن جَادَلُوكَ فَقُلِ اللَّهُ أَعْلَمُ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ. If they dispute with you, say Allah knows best what you do.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Somehow it seems that knowing this fact, that Allah knows best what you do, the Almighty Allah is both relieving the heart of the Holy Prophet and at the same time is telling him what to do. It's both relieving and it's both some kind of teaching. And on the other hand, when the good people, the people with good deeds, the Muslims, the ones who are believers, know this fact, that even the prophets will be confronted, even the ones having miracles and logics will be confronted by some obstinate people. This would give them also patience. This would also give patience to the hearts of the believers. So that's why the verses, and if they dispute with you, say Allah knows best what you do. So if they do not believe you, you'd have to refer them to the Day of Judgment, because Allah knows best what you do. And He will judge you. Allahu yahkumu baynakum yawm al-qiyamah. So this is one of the best ways to control the disputes, to control the confrontations, believing in the Day of Judgment, and also reminding some people of this fact. So, Allahu yahkumu baynakum yawm al-qiyamah. Allah will judge between you on the Day of Judgment. The best and true form of judgment will only happen if complete knowledge is prior to that. So, at first it says, Allah knows best what you do, and as a result, He will yahkumu baynakum yawm al-qiyamah. That's why the Almighty Allah is the best judge, because He knows best what you do. فَقُلِ اللَّهُ أَعْلَمُ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ. Regarding these two verses, some of the commentators have said that it means that if they dispute with the Prophet ﷺ about sacrifice and cancellation of their religion, he should tell them that Allah knows best their rejection, and He will give them their chastisement. And in the next verse, the Quran announces that Allah will judge between them about what they used to defer, and in hereafter, where everything returns to unity and oneness, and those differences will be removed, He will make the facts manifest to all of us. So, the faith in hereafter is the best thing for bringing the disputations and the differences under subjugation. Allahu yahkumu baynakum yawm al-qiyamah fima kuntum fihi takhtalifun. Also, this part of the verse where it says kuntum fihi takhtalifun means these differences which cause some of these confrontations actually have long history, and the best way to control them is to remind some people of the Day of Judgment. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kHz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kHz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat Orbat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Reporters.
Tensions between Beijing and Washington escalated once again, this time after the U.S. guided missile destroyer USS John McCain sailed through the Taiwan Strait despite repeated objections from China. The transit was the first such move since the inauguration of Joe Biden as U.S. president. The U.S. Navy claimed the move demonstrates Washington's, quote, commitment to a free and open Indo-Pacific, saying that the U.S. military would, quote, continue to fly, sail, and operate anywhere international law allows. Beijing, however, considers any passing through the waterway as provocative and a breach of its sovereignty. It says such operations threaten stability in the region and embolden separatists on the self-ruled island. China is also strongly against deepening ties between Washington and Taipei, since it sees Taiwan as part of its territory. It has repeatedly called on the United States to respect the One China policy and stop interfering in the country's internal affairs. Taiwan, however, views itself an independent territory. The previous U.S. administration under Donald Trump tried to bolster Taiwan's international standing by sending several high-level envoys to the island. It also approved sales of sophisticated weapons to Taipei, including F-16 fighter jets and advanced missiles. The moves drew strong condemnation from China and caused relations between the two countries to sink to the lowest level in decades. With Biden taking the helm at the White House, there was some optimism that Washington-Beijing ties would improve. However, it so appears that there is no end to the downward spiral. Experts believe Biden is also using Taiwan as a playing card against China.
The Biden administration, despite having quite a bit of experience, is treating Taiwan like it's a playing card. Unfortunately, on the Chinese side, it's not a playing card, it's a red line. So these are the type of very dangerous situations which can, in fact, lead to an armed conflict.
Taiwan is one of the multiple fronts in the Sino-American standoff. The dwelling economic powers have been in loggerheads over a host of issues. The U.S. has recently blacklisted several Chinese officials over a new security law in Hong Kong that Washington claims to be against freedom of speech. China, however, says the law will return stability to the economic hub that has been embroiled in anti-government protests for months. China accuses the U.S. and other Western countries of being behind the protests. Washington has also sided with Beijing's rivals in the maritime dispute over the South China Sea and routinely dispatches warships and warplanes to the region. The two sides are also involved in a bitter trade and cyber wars. During Trump's presidency, the U.S. imposed sweeping tariffs on Chinese imports, prompting tit-for-tat measures from China. Experts believe that there is a bipartisan anti-China sentiment among U.S. politicians.
There's a bipartisan anti-China feeling, not only among the American people, but also in Congress.
The recent moves and statements from the Biden administration suggest that tensions between Beijing and Washington are far from over. Biden's policy on China has so far proven to be different from that of Trump's administration, only in rhetoric, not in kind.
Jobs and working conditions are much more in danger today than in normal times. That's why the main French trade unions call for a nationwide strike and demonstrations in order to defend jobs, salaries and working conditions. The COVID crisis is leading to an important loss of jobs and to an explosion of poverty. Trade union leaders call for a social spring.
The social spring is a formula we use to say that social question cannot be denied in this difficult period. So the anger we notice every day in the enterprises should find an expression. We want our demands to be heard.
These workers of the big French multinational Total are threatened with dismissal, despite financial support from the state. Other big companies in France, such as the pharmaceutical Sanofi, car constructors Renault and PSA, and Airbus, also benefit from important tax reductions and financial aid from the government. But that does not prevent them to fire workers.
Sanofi receives about 120 million euros every year for research. They pay less taxes and they are going to pay 4 billion euros to their shareholders. Today they announced a record of their profits. Meanwhile, they are firing workers and they did not find a vaccine. There is a problem.
France has not been able to produce its own vaccine, unlike the USA, Russia, China, and even Cuba. A big disappointment for French people. Experts say it's due to the continuous privatization. Scientific research has been sacrificed for short-term profits.
We can't continue with a pharmaceutical industry that's making a huge amount of profit without investing their benefits in research for the general interest. Public research has to be maintained. The fact that Sanofi has not been able to produce a vaccine reveals a real problem in the system.
According to the National Institute for Economic Studies, INSEE, the French gross domestic product, GDP, went down with more than 8% in 2020. Less than expected, but still a record since the Second World War. Unemployment increased with 8%. Nevertheless, the main French companies are making more profits today than before the COVID crisis. Profits for few, sacrifices for many. It's difficult to organize workers during lockdowns and curfews. Fundamental liberties are put in danger with the COVID crisis. A united front, as shown today in France, is one of the means to go forward. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Senior leaders of combined opposition parties, including Pakistan People's Party and Muslim League of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, gathered in Islamabad to decide new course of action after opposition's deadline to Prime Minister Imran Khan to resign expired. After hours-long meeting, they announced that people from all over Pakistan would start a mass long march towards the capital Islamabad on March 26 this year to force the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan to step down and hold fresh general elections. The opposition blames the military to have rigged general elections in favor of Prime Minister Imran Khan in 2018.
We are struggling to get rid of an illegitimate government which was formed through rigging in general elections. We are trying to restore the sanctity of the public mandate.
A better sense must prevail among the opposition parties. The opposition must understand that their protests would not bring down our government. When we were in the opposition, we held protest rallies in Islamabad for 126 days to bring down the government.
The opposition launched a public mobilization campaign late last year across Pakistan to prepare people for the long march next month, something which government believes received a lackluster response. Prime Minister Imran Khan says that the opposition parties turned against him after he rejected their backdoor request to stop prosecuting top opposition leaders on corruption charges. The opposition's decision to start a mass long march has come after anti-graft watchdog started prosecuting top opposition leaders on money laundering charges. The former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has already been convicted on money laundering charges.
Analysts believe that the opposition parties enjoy little public support after their top leaders were tainted with the corruption charges. However, discontentment prevailed among people over unprecedented price hike after Pakistan devalued its currency under IMF pressure, something opposition failed to exploit in its favor. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
February 4th is World Cancer Day, and on this day, thousands of Gazan cancer patients suffer immensely due to the crippling Israeli blockade. After being diagnosed with cancer, patients in Gaza have to wait for months before being able to receive treatment. Gaza hospitals suffer from acute shortage of medicines, especially for cancer patients. Getting an Israeli permit to access the health care needed outside the impoverished enclave can be a stressful and unpredictable process, and many apply multiple times before being able to exit.
Israel usually doesn't allow Palestinian patients to travel through the Erez crossing despite having an exit permit. They only need to leave the Gaza Strip to receive required treatments.
Currently, cancer patients in Gaza suffer acute shortage of the essential drugs needed for their treatment with a 50% deficit rate. Despite the high number of cancer cases in Gaza, the Israeli regime also refuses to allow spare parts for radiation therapy machines to enter Gaza.
Radiation therapy, especially for breast cancer patients, is not available in the Gaza Strip, and patients must go to hospitals in Israel or the occupied West Bank for treatment. Radiation therapy is a hard process and takes a very long time to get an Israeli permit for such procedures. Oftentimes, cancer patients miss their hospital appointments due to delayed exit permits.
There are around 14,000 cancer patients in the Gaza Strip, 47% male and 53% female. Breast cancer is the most commonly diagnosed cancer among females. Cancer patients have also complained of humiliating treatment at the Israeli-controlled Erez crossing.
The process in the Israeli crossing is extremely humiliating because they insist on strip searching you. I was very sick and they kept interrogating me for 3 hours and then they began to strip search me. I told them that I had a mastectomy, but the Israelis did not let me go through until they did a full body search.
Under the current circumstances, the health condition of many cancer patients is likely to further deteriorate.
Human rights organizations in the Gaza Strip have repeatedly urged the international community to help bring an end to the Israeli blockade and save the lives of cancer patients. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
According to the International Organization for Migration, at least 600 families were forcibly displaced from their homes in Yemen in January due to the increasing confrontations in several governorates of the country.
The areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition suffer from instability, insecurity, and the spread of armed groups. Therefore, the residents of these areas are leaving to save their lives from missiles, projectiles, and armed confrontations. These have all been confirmed by the international organizations, including IOM.
The IOM says Al-Hudaydah, Ad-Dala, and Taiz governorates have the highest number of displaced people. As the war continues in these areas, most displacements occurred during the last week of January, indicating that 2021 may witness more of this crisis.
The issue of displacement can only be solved by lifting the imposed siege. Those displaced greatly suffer from the absence of support from international organizations. These people must be among the priorities of the humanitarian operations. It is shameful to see an increase in the number of displaced people in 2021 due to the continuing armed conflicts.
Millions of families had to leave their homes for survival since the beginning of the war in Yemen in 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on the Arab country, killing thousands of civilians, including women and the children. 2021 doesn't seem to be better than the previous years for Yemenis, as the war continues to create new difficulties for thousands of people who had to migrate for their lives. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has signaled that it is willing to return to the 2015 nuclear deal from which former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally exited in 2018 and reimposed anti-Tehran sanctions. But 2 weeks after taking the helm at the White House, Washington's return to the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, still hangs in the balance. The U.S. says Iran should first come back to full compliance with the accord, but Tehran says it was Washington that walked away and hence it should fulfill all its obligations, which include the lifting of all sanctions. Amid the standoff, Iran's foreign minister warned that the Biden administration has a limited window of opportunity to re-enter the agreement. He, meanwhile, suggested the question over who must take the first step in returning to the JCPOA could be resolved by EU foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell.
He can put his hat as the coordinator of the joint position and sort of choreograph the actions that are needed to be taken by the United States and the actions that are needed to be taken by Iran.
In reaction, the European Union said it is working extremely hard to salvage the deal and is in talks with the U.S. administration to see if sanctions could be lifted. And this is how the U.S. reacted to Zarif's suggestion.
If Iran comes back into full compliance with its obligations under the JCPOA, the United States would do the same. And then we would then use that as a platform to build a longer and a stronger agreement that also addresses other areas of concern.
Such a stance was earlier echoed by Secretary of State Antony Blinken, which is in line with Washington's policy to expand the JCPOA beyond Iran's nuclear issue. French President Emmanuel Macron has also said Saudi Arabia should be involved in any new negotiations with Iran about the deal. But Iran's president has reiterated that the JCPOA remains unchanged.
I clearly tell the global community, and especially the countries in the JCPOA, whether it's 4 plus 1 or maybe 5 plus 1 in the future, that no clause of the JCPOA will change. Know this. And no one will be added to it.
After the U.S. pullout of the JCPOA in May 2018, Iran waited for a year and gave leeway to the European signatories, the EU, Britain, France, and Germany, to make up for the U.S. move. They, however, failed to live up to their commitments. Iran then reacted by scaling back on its commitments under the accord. Iran says its measures are fully reversible upon the full compliance by the remaining signatories. Presently, questions arise as whether the Biden administration will follow the path of its predecessor against Iran or will try to rectify the Trump-era policy, which has been described as a failed approach even by some of Washington's close allies.
Italy's President of the Republic, Sergio Mattarella, gave Mario Draghi a mandate to attempt to form a new government after efforts to salvage the coalition supporting outgoing Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte had failed. Draghi, 73 years of age, had largely vanished from public view since his mandate as President of the European Central Bank ended after 8 years in 2019. His name emerged as a potential prime minister when the government crisis sparked in Italy in mid-January. The crisis had been triggered by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, whose unexpected decision to withdraw his small party's support to the previous executive had forced Conte to resign.
Con questa speranza,
I am confident that the unity and the capacity to give a responsible response will emerge from the discussion with the parties, with the groups in Parliament. The challenges are to defeat the pandemic, complete the vaccination campaign, offer responses to everyday problems, and relaunch the country using the extraordinary resources from the EU.
The country desperately needs to secure an immediate massive injection of liquidity into its staggering economy. Italy has reported its biggest contraction in GDP since the end of World War II following the pandemic. The National Bureau of Statistics estimates the country's economy shrank by almost 9% last year.
What is there to understand is if the next government will be technical or political. This is for Prime Minister-designate Draghi to find out. Draghi unusually met with outgoing Prime Minister Conte after receiving the mandate to see if he can also count on his support.
It cannot be taken for granted that a Draghi executive would win substantial backing from parties across the political spectrum. Many five-star movement lawmakers have said they will not vote in favor of a technocrat government led by Draghi, arguing the only possible executive must be a political one.
Also, nationalist Brothers of Italy leader Giorgia Meloni warned her party would not support Draghi as prime minister, calling her lies. The anti-immigrant, anti-EU League party of Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi's centre-right Forza Italia party to abstain any vote for him. Max Civili, Rome.
Russia's Sputnik V vaccine is more than 91% effective against COVID-19. The news was published Tuesday in The Lancet, a British medical journal. This is great news for all the countries already administering the vaccine and all those looking for alternative supplies.
It's unconditionally an epoch-making event. There are four vaccines in the world which published what's called the third phase of trials. Our vaccine is among the three most effective vaccines in the world.
After the announcement, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said every vaccine is welcome in the European Union. The bloc's vaccine rollout is lagging behind the UK and the US, and desperate and disappointed member states, including Hungary, are looking elsewhere for supplies.
The centralized vaccine procurement of Brussels has failed. This is risking the lives of Europeans and the quick relaunching of the European economy. That's why we have looked for new sources of supply. We were the first, but it is unlikely that we will be the only ones in the European Union in this effort.
Armenia, Belarus, and Serbia have already got Sputnik V. European countries which are not EU members and say they were losing out waiting for the COVAX program, which was supposed to make vaccines available to everyone, to deliver. Countries hard hit by Western sanctions have also approved Sputnik V. Venezuela has already received its first shipment, and Iran's first batch is expected any day now. Russia has donated 5,000 doses to the Palestinians in the occupied territories as well. The World Health Organization says to end the COVID-19 pandemic, it has to be ended for everyone, everywhere. Nonetheless, rich countries are hoarding and rolling out vaccines, while the least developed nations watch and wait. It may take years for the poorest to get the jab. Bianca Rahimi, London.
That's the precise number of refugees currently barely surviving in awful conditions on the islands of Greece, apparently a proud member of the 27-nation EU. Legislators have been discussing the situation here in the European Parliament, Brussels.
Most of the time, people are locked up in the camps. Does the Commission think this is imprisonment? And if not, what is the difference between this and imprisonment?
There are not enough toilets or hot showers in the overcrowded camps. EU lawmakers say this is all the more appalling against the backdrop of a global pandemic.
Tents have been set up in October, and only in January they start winterization, as if the arrival of winter was a big surprise. And they're tents. It's very basic.
The Parliament debate heard that 60% of the refugees have reported suicidal thoughts to doctors. On Lesbos alone, there are 129 babies under the age of one. EU nations pledged to take in 5,145 refugees from the islands, but just half that number have been relocated.
There are many people who have now been granted international protection who are still stuck in the camps. What's going to happen with them? Do we have commitment by other member states to take over people, and why is this not happening?
The argument has been made the EU has a special responsibility in this regard because of the very destabilising roles some of the bloc's countries have played in Africa and in the Middle East.
The shape of the current political landscape in the EU does not inject confidence that the bloc's asylum policy will change anytime soon, according to experts.
There is across Europe now this sense that that of xenophobia, of populism, a resistance to seeing more migration. So it makes it very, very tough to do.
Lawmakers say EU governments are using the pandemic as a reason to extricate themselves from their fundamental human rights responsibilities. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Allah, Allah. Allah, 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 Allah.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن
القلوب. Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.